Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I think the bank failures were not due to a lack of regulation. They were due to mismanagement and poor supervision.
We're getting a game plan from the tee, and they're really focusing on getting the system back on track.
TikTok is terrible. But if you ban TikTok today and you just ban TikTok, there's going to be TikTok 2 next week.
We want Massachusetts to become more affordable, and we want it to become a place where businesses and others are looking to stay and looking to grow.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business
with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortsleeve, and Kim Kerrigan
on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
Okay, here we go. Monday, June the 5th. Welcome to Bloomberg Bay State Business. We're with you till 6 o'clock tonight. Joe Shortsleeve, Tom Maroney, Kim Kerrigan, and Mastu Janet Wu. Yeah, we are all here. We've got 60 degrees. We're in a sort of a slow warm-up from a very dank and cold weekend. Equity markets as we come on the air. Oh, look at that. Okay, at this very moment, we're mixed. The Dow is negative, but the NASDAQ is slightly moved into positive territory. So in this 3 o'clock hour, Ann Mastu, she's moderating a panel at the Bio International Convention in Boston today. Yeah, thousands are gathering at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. It's a prestigious gathering of the top minds in bioscience and biotech, and Ann will be along in just a moment. Also, oil prices. Well, they're up today, but this is as Saudi Arabia pledges to lower output by 1 million barrels a day following double-digit price declines. Mark Shieldrop, spokesperson for AAA Northeast, will join us at 3:15 to talk about what the outlook is.
Kim Kerrigan, what's on your mind?
Well, first off, we've got a Red Sox game today. They were supposed to be off today, but of course, Friday night got postponed. So the Rays are still here in town. It's at 4:05. We're keeping our fingers crossed that Mother Nature will be cooperative this time around. But
really?
In the meantime, on Saturday, well,
you want them to play.
Joe, okay, now we're going to try to split this series.
All right.
Okay,
yeah.
We've played three. We've won one.
Yeah.
Joe Castiglione was in the booth. He was calling the game on Saturday. Yeah. And the Rays outfielder, Jose Siri, stepped up to the plate. And, of course, he said what he would normally say. Let's take a listen.
So first and second. Still only one out for Jose Siri. Four men have reached base, two have scored.
Which Joseph? Castiglione.
Wait a minute. Did you hear that?
I don't know where
Siri.
That came from.
That was Siri. Somebody activated Siri.
He did. When he said right Siri, yeah. The phone started to speak and started to ask him what he wanted in the booth.
That's interesting.
And he laughed, and everybody got a real big chuckle out of it.
Let's talk a little bit about gas and oil prices. You know, Memorial Day is behind us, and people are thinking about getting in their car and traveling. And then we get this, Saudi Arabia announcing that they're going to lower output by an extra 1 million barrels a day for July. Everybody was thinking, uh-oh. Well, prices did jump initially, but then they seemed to come back down. Headline in the Bloomberg Terminal, oil trims gains as traders wait for OPEC cuts to materialize. Let's bring in Mark Shieldrop. He is the spokesperson for American Automobile Association here in the Northeast. Mark is a regular visitor of the program. Thank you for joining us, Mark. So let's talk a little bit about, well, what is AAA's outlook for gas prices these days, given this recent announcement?
Yeah, you know, this announcement comes on the heels of a similar announcement earlier this year. And, you know, looking at what the markets are doing right now, there's a feeling of being underwhelmed by this. Initially, we did see a few, you know, dollar surge this morning. It looked like Brent and WTI were on the way up. Meanwhile, they're both barely up 50 cents today. So obviously the initial momentum is kind of subsiding. And that's, to me, an indication that the underlying fundamentals that we tend to bring up each time we come on your show have relatively remained unchanged for the most part. So we might see, you know, a couple cent increase here or there. We might see a little bit of an increase over the next couple of weeks, but overall, I don't see this really jolting the market very much. And that's really because Russian oil is still going on in the market. Hmm. And even though the Saudis want to get that price of a barrel of oil up, the other nations in that group may not necessarily be really on the same page. So I think we're not going to see a significant drop in production, despite what the Saudis are saying today.
Yeah, so Mark, you say the fundamentals remain, in one of those being the Russian oil still available.
Yeah, it's still flowing into the market, for sure. And also our inventory situation has gotten a little bit better here in the Northeast. Demand still, you know, this Memorial Day week was strong. It looks like we were just over 9 million barrels a day, but that's not record numbers by any means. It's only 1% above last year. Refinery output is really strong right now. So there's not much really out there that would suggest that we're in for any real supply tightness. There's not a lot of wiggle room. I don't want to see big drawdowns over the next couple of weeks, but demand generally softens right after Memorial Day. So the next few weeks, you know, we'll keep an eye on demand. That's really the number I want to see right now. So when Wednesday's numbers from the EIA come out, I'm going to look at that number closely. If it's below 9 million barrels a day of gasoline demand, to me, that's an indication that we are not going to see much higher gas prices in the short term.
That's my question, Mark. I'm curious at AAA Northeast, how closely you track consumer demand for gas. Is it a weekly number? Is it a monthly number? And I ask that in the context of, like, I think so many people had plans to perhaps go away this weekend or travel this weekend. I know Tom and I both scrapped our plans because the weather was so terrible. So I don't know. I'm curious as to how closely you track that number.
Pretty closely. I mean, I look at the number from the EIA every week. I get regular daily updates from one of our partner analyst organizations that sends me alerts. If it's a refinery fire in Texas, I know about it within a few minutes. But when we look at demand, I track it each week. So we also compare it year over year. Pandemic threw things off a little bit, but when I see below 9, to me, not a lot of demand. When I see above 9, hey, that's strong. And then once we go higher and higher and higher, that's when we start to get to the point where that's really solid demand numbers. So we're kind of hovering around that point where it's strong. We have signs of, you know, people spending, people traveling. It's not like we're in lockdown. It's not like we're in the depths of a big recession or anything like that. So the consumer is definitely propping things up. But it just doesn't quite have that punch that you see when the economy is going gangbusters. People are spending money. Demand's really strong. And I think some of that demand might be based on the fact that commercial activity may be a little bit down. So, you know, maybe our employers are spending a little bit less on gas, but we still are here at home.
We're not trying hard enough. Hey, Mark, you know, I was hoping to unveil this today, the Shield Drop Seismometer. It's it's something we've been working on here at the program with our technical crew. But I'll give it to you straight. So right now, current average, $3.55 for a gallon of regular in Massachusetts. A year ago today, $4.94. You might know where I'm going with this. What is it going to be on July 4?
Oh, I'm going to say, ooh, that's a tough one.
348.
Right about where we are now, just a little bit left.
We're going to feed that into the seismometer, and every time you come on, we're just going to, this machine's going to get better and better. And then.
Yeah, definitely. So, no, I appreciate the tracking. First of all, I'm honored, you know, for Bloomberg to even coin something.
You should be.
That's feather in my cap. I'm definitely boasting to my.
Shield Drop says $3.48 on July 4th.
And your listeners know not to put real money behind that, right? I'm not giving investment advice.
Well, I don't know. So. No. Okay. Good disclaimer.
Tom wants real money. Trust me, he does.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I look at the July futures right now, that's about the range they're at when you bake in, you know, the cost from wholesale to resale. So I think I might be pretty close because at least that's what the market seems to be.
Well, don't go bragging before the fact. All right.
All right. You got 30 seconds to give us sort of that outlook. Let's fill in the blanks there as it relates to July 4th. What's the travel outlook?
Yeah, well, the travel outlook, I think, is going to remain strong. Bookings are still up on our end. People are still seeing a lot of travel demand throughout the industry. Jet fuel is in strong demand. Inventories for that have gone down. The airlines have been putting out a lot of messaging saying travel is still strong. My wife and I are currently looking at accommodations later this summer to take our daughters out for some fun. And we see the prices and we see lack of ability. We're not exactly sure yet. Oh. We're thinking somewhere here in the Northeast, so I'll take some suggestions if you have any recommendations. But the kids are getting a little older. They're too old for Storyland.
We continue to check in with local businesses that are entering their high season. As the weather gets warmer, Boston Harbor City Cruises gets busier. But the company, with roots dating back a century, actually transports people year-round. Our Janet Wu joins us right now in our Boston studio with a company update. Janet.
In case you did not know, this company has incredible roots here here in Boston. It was started in 1926 by a young sailor named Matty Hughes, who offered sightseeing cruises on the Charles River. Those trips cost 10 cents and were a big hit with Bostonians during the sweltering summers. The company would grow in boats and services and locations, different areas of water here around Boston, through four generations of the same family, until Boston Harbor Cruises was sold to a global tourism and transportation conglomerate called Hornblower. That sale happened in 2020. I sat down with the general manager of the now Boston Harbor City Cruises, and I began by asking Bob Lawler how business is shaping up this season.
We're seeing great trends in our business this year. I'd say currently we're up 10% over last year just to start the season. We're hoping those trends will continue because last year was phenomenal.
Remind us of the size and variety of your fleet.
Well, we have over 40 vessels that operate out of Boston and the North Shore. Those vessels are transportation, sightseeing, dinner cruises, everything from whale watches to harbor islands to ferry service. We do it all.
We are speaking with Bob Lawler, Vice President and General Manager of Boston Harbor City Cruises. Let's talk about the tourism side. What is the most popular water experience that you offer?
Well, for many years now, the most popular has been our New England Aquarium Whale Watch. That leaves from Long Wharf, Central Wharf here in Boston, and is about a 3.5-hour tour out to Stellwagen Bank to look at the beautiful and majestic humpback whale, as well as a wide variety of marine life.
Obviously, that is seasonal because the whales are not always here. When do you offer the whale cruises?
We do offer it right up through November. About mid-November is when we stop. We do get those going mid-May. And since then, we've had very large crowds. And currently, we will be operating about 4 trips per day on the weekdays and up to as many as 8 trips a day on the weekend.
And how have the whales been so far?
So far, they've been amazing. Just like last season, the humpback whales are active. They're feeding. Stellwagen Bank offshore is a natural feeding ground for the humpback whales, and they are there in plenty.
Can you remind us how much this costs?
Sure. The whale watch starts at $65 per person. Again, we'll be running it all summer long.
Overall, in the entire company, because you have so many different types of boats, how many people do you serve per day?
On a busy weekend, we'll serve upwards of over 5,000 passengers per day.
This is one of the most iconic local companies that was sold in the early days of the pandemic to a larger tourism marine group. Remind us of the history of this company that was a family-run entity for nearly a century.
Sure. The Nolan family started Boston Harbor Cruises in the 1920s. Since then, they've been continuously operating sightseeing tours around Boston. Throughout the 90s, the company continued to grow and add more vessels and more transportation service, including water taxis, MBTA ferry service, ferries to Provincetown, Cape Cod, and up to Salem, Massachusetts. So we've continued to grow, and then we were purchased by another large tourism and hospitality company, which also includes here in Boston, the Spirit of Boston, the large dinner boat, and also the Odyssey, and two other private dining vessels, Seaport Elite and Boston Elite.
That larger company is Hornblower. It has now been 3 years, a little bit more, since Boston Harbor Cruises was sold to Hornblower. It underwent a slight rebranding, adding City to its name, Boston Harbor City Cruises, and also dropping the U from Harbor. What changes have happened in the last 3 years?
Well, we've gotten great support from our parent company, which has allowed us to continue to operate throughout the pandemic. That's been the number one thing. Locally here in Boston, we've remained not the same family, but the same feel, where we are focused on the guest, focused on providing exceptional service and providing a great entertainment value to locals and tourists alike.
We are speaking with Bob Lawler, Vice President and General Manager of Boston Harbor City Cruises. Was the pandemic a reason for the sale?
It was not. The reason for the sale was, I believe, not speaking for the Nolan family that sold, but it was the right time for them, the right thing to do for their family. And it was the time where Hornblower was trying to grow and continue to make a mark worldwide in the experiential travel market.
Can you tell us about the annual revenue of the company?
Here in Boston, we do close to about $40 million in annual sales.
And was the sale price ever revealed for the transfer of the company?
Not to me.
Okay. Hornblower is an international organization. It operates in 112 countries. How has that impacted business here in Boston?
What it really does is it allows us to reach more guests. So as we're operating across North America and around the world, we have access to those who may want to take a cruise in London. And if you take a cruise with City Cruises in London, that enables us to reach out to you and say, hey, well, you're from, let's say, Chicago. When you come back to the States, why not take a City Cruise in the Port of Chicago? Or why not do that in San Francisco? Or if you live here in Boston, come join Boston Harbor City Cruises and get that great guest service that you experienced when you were traveling overseas or in one of our other countries.
You just talked about the annual revenue of the company now. Has it grown a lot since it was acquired?
We are still climbing back from the pandemic. We have not reached our 2019 revenue numbers yet, but we're hoping to continue to do that. Each year has been a little bit better, and we really think that if the weather holds and we have another great summer like we did last year, we could get back to those 2018-2019 numbers very soon.
We are speaking with Bob Lawler, Vice President and General Manager of Boston Harbor City Cruises. You have many modes of transportation from fast to slow. You talked about the dinner cruises. We talked about the whale watches. Describe what you get when you take a Godzilla ride.
Godzilla is a thrill ride. It is a high-speed thrill vessel that goes out both in the inner and outer harbor, and it is propelled by water jets, which enable it to have superior mobility. Enables it to do some tricks and some stunts, which include very sharp 360 turns, what we call burying the bow, where water will spray right up over the top of you and get everybody wet on board. And we just go fast around the out in the outer harbor and get a great look at the city as we're giving everybody a thrill. I describe it like a roller coaster on the water.
So customers should be prepared to get doused.
That is correct. You will get wet on that boat.
I want to go back and ask you one more question about the whale watches because they are so popular. It is in partnership with the New England Aquarium. Does it also financially help support the aquarium?
We do. A portion of our ticket revenue goes to the aquarium, and we have a longstanding partnership where we provide research as well as volunteer naturalists from the aquarium who come out and help us not only document and research the whales, but also give some of the great information to our guests and really make it an environmental and learning experience for everybody on board.
I have one more question about the tourism side of the company. For your sightseeing experiences, what is the breakdown of local customers versus out-of-town visitors?
We are pretty close to 50-50, and that does depend on the type of cruise that is going out. To our Boston Harbor Islands, which I consider our tourism, we do a lot more locals. We get a lot of visitors from the greater Boston area all the way up to New Hampshire and down to Rhode Island, so all of New England. When we're doing a 60-minute historic sightseeing cruise, that is mostly tourists that are visiting Boston and just looking for a view of Boston Harbor. And then on our whale watches, it's a mix of everyone. Everybody wants to come and do a whale watch.
And again, as you heard, the whales are here, well, actually out of Stillwell Bank, and they are very active right now. This is the height of the season. Very quickly, have any of you done the whale watch or a Godzilla?
Not Godzilla. No. I have not done Godzilla, but I've done the sightseeing cruises on Father's Day. I think it was last year. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. Yeah. Great take.
I'd like to do Godzilla. It's $54. I'm just looking it up here, but it there's a lot of people on that.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Boat. There's like
we'll have to strap you down
dozens.
And make sure you have water wicking clothes. I do want to point out that this is not just a sightseeing company. And by the way, have you done it, Kim?
I have not. Godzilla, I have not.
Okay, so maybe we will all do this together as a little group out. So, as we said, this is not just a sightseeing company. Boston Harbor City Cruises also takes commuters.
One major topic on this program for really the past couple of 3 years at this point has been the efforts to build more housing, the lack of housing. And it seems to be a theme when people talk about, well, you know, this outward migration issue. A lot of it has to do with the price of housing and the lack of housing. So, needless to say, this headline caught our attention in the Boston Globe today. To meet new state housing law, Newton aims to make its villages a little taller. One of Boston's largest suburbs has a year-end deadline to comply with a state law that could require it to permit more than 8,000 additional homes. We reached out to the president and CEO of the Charles River Chamber of Commerce, Greg Reedman, and he joins us now on the line here. Greg, regular visitor to the program, thanks for joining us today. All right.
Great to be back, guys.
Yeah. So tell us what's going on in Newton.
So, you know, as you mentioned, we all know we need to build more housing, and if you're going to do it somewhere, you've got to decide where, right? So either you have to take, you know, your small suburban neighborhood and build more housing there, or you need to put it where the shops and stores are and build above shops and stores and next to shops and stores and make it a little denser. So if you don't want to totally change neighborhoods, although some neighborhoods need some changing and would be changed under this, the other alternative is to build things a little bit taller. And the way that Newton is approaching this state law with, as you mentioned, the deadline at the end of this year, is to make the village centers, and Newton has a number of them, taller.
Yeah, so Greg, talk about that. I mean, what's the restriction now, and how high up do they want to go?
Well, so it depends which village, and I won't get into all the nuance of it, but in some places in the denser villages, it could be as tall as 4.5 stories. And a lot of, when you look at those little village centers, look at pictures now, you realize it's just one level of retail or restaurant and nothing above it. So this would allow you to go taller in those neighborhoods, which in my mind makes a lot of sense because it brings people, customers right next to those stores. So it's great for the businesses. It makes it a more walkable neighborhood. These villages that they're selecting are close to the T for the most part. They're on the Green Line. So it's really a much more commuter-friendly idea.
Greg, where are they in this process? Because the Globe article, it says they're attempting to rewrite key sections and that they're motivated by that. Where is this whole process at this point?
So the city has proposed, been through two iterations of maps. The most recent one is the one that Andrew wrote about in the Globe today. There probably will be some revisions to it. But they're facing a state-mandated deadline at the end of the year to prove something.
Greg Reedman is with us, heads up the Charles River Regional Chamber of Commerce, talking about these height restrictions and proposal to amend that in Newton so they can build multifamily housing. So there are 13 villages in Newton, and they some of them very different. So you are you suggesting that this would only apply to some of the villages, these amendments, as it were?
Right. And so the MBTA, the state law that we're talking about, requires building these districts, rezoning close to public transit. Okay. And Newton really is one of those fortunate suburban communities that has both the Green Line and the commuter rail. Right. Most of the changes in this case are along the Green Line.
So Auburndale, Newtonville, West Newton. What is there pushback here? Are people saying no way?
Well, no, come on, Joe. There's always pushback when it comes to building more housing. It's a lot of people who are nervous about this, but I do think that, generally speaking, people have begun to understand. You mentioned spending 3.5 years talking about housing. So have we. I think finally the public understands that there needs to be something done here. And the way to do it, if you're worried about traffic and you're worried about density and you want to preserve your neighborhoods, is to allow more housing in the downtown areas. And Newton, like I said, has little ones. And we're really, what we're talking about is Newton Center, Newton Highlands, Waubun is kind of the main area where a lot of this would happen, but also in some of the other villages.
But Greg, there is talk of a lawsuit, right? I mean, Newton is notorious for this NIMBYism that
right.
people will stand up and fight these issues. So, I mean, how concerned are you?
Yeah, so housing is the third rail of politics in Newton. And I think not just the lawsuit, but there could be a ballot referendum. As you recall, 3 years ago, when the Northland development was approved, the opponents were able to get it on the ballot, and there was a whole ballot question for it. Voters agreed that the Northland project was good and went forward and approved it. So there very well could be the city council approves zoning, the mayor approves it, and then the voters are asked to weigh in. What I don't know about that is how that will comply with the state law. If we're supposed to have the zoning in place by the end of the calendar year and the voter referendum doesn't happen until next year, not sure what that means.
How much do you know about the politics here? Is the mayor strongly supportive? Are there city councilors that are maybe more influential than others that have given their voice to this? Where are we politically?
That's a great question. So I think the mayor is very much in favor of this. The maps and the new proposal comes out of her department. That's under her direction. There are many city councilors who've come to recognize that the city needs more housing and build more. Newton has a large city council, 24 city councilors, so there's always a chance that there'll be a couple swing votes right on that threshold of approving this.
Hmm. Greg Riedman's our guest. He's the president and CEO of the Charles River Chamber of Commerce, talking about this proposal in Newton now moving forward to make buildings taller. Okay, you mentioned it a little bit, but specifically, take us into a neighborhood in Newton where perhaps buildings would now be allowed to be four stories tall where they currently aren't.
Right. So I think Newton Center is a perfect opportunity. Newton Center's got, for those of you who are familiar with it, big parking lot in the middle, a lot of retail stores along a number of streets. Making buildings taller there makes a lot of sense for everybody. And it's right there on the Green Line. And so that 4.5 story height there makes a lot of sense. Yep. Like a smaller village and maybe 2.5 stories is the right number. So the zoning is done to based on scale. The closer you get to the neighborhood, you can't build as tall as you can right in the center of the town.
You know, Greg, this is quite interesting. We've talked about this transit-oriented housing and the requirements thereof, and we've actually had people on this show that are pushing back, the mayor of Woburn, for instance. I would imagine that, you know, other cities that are as dense around these rail stops as Newton is are undergoing the same sort of discussion. Do you know if that's true? Is Newton looking at other places and how they've done it?
Well, so the great example at this moment is Lexington, which has approved zoning, and they've actually approved more, a bigger territory and more units of housing than the law requires.
Really?
And the way Newton's zoning proposal is, the current proposal, it would allow to build up to 10,000 units of housing, even though the law requires only 8,330. Now, you have to be careful because people can get alarmed there. Just because the zoning allows it doesn't mean that many units of housing would be built. Mm-hmm. It just means that a parcel in town can be built for a small apartment building or maybe a two-family house without going through all the permit process. And any changes that would happen in any of these neighborhoods across Massachusetts, and there's 150 of them that are subject to this law, it's going to take years, probably decades, before that many houses get built, if ever. But the need to change the zoning laws to make it easier is what's at stake here.
Greg, how do you see this issue playing out in the other communities that you represent, namely Needham, Watertown, and Wellesley?
So the way the law is written, the smaller communities that are not directly on a train station have a full year and a halfway. They don't have to do it till the end of 2024. But Needham, Wellesley, and Watertown are all very much in lockstep. They're preparing their proposals to also add more housing, and they are also talking about more housing inside their, closer to their town center.
Bio 2023, Ann Mostow, a panelist at this giant biotech conference here in Boston, drawing people from across the globe. No kidding, because one gentleman is in our studio now, the 1061 studio. George Freeman is the Minister of State for Science, Research, and Innovation in the UK. And he's brought with him an entourage into the studio and all these smiling faces. George, welcome to our program.
Tom, thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Well, it's lovely to have you with us. We understand, for instance, the UK is home to 1 in 3 biotech startups in all of Europe that were founded in the last decade. So you people are busy. You have a lot of reps here. Joe was, before we get on the air again, Joe was asking, you have 1,000 Brits at this convocation?
We do. Look, bio is a huge, huge event globally, and for the UK life science sector, it's a huge opportunity. So we got a reception tonight at the consulate. I think we got 300 Brits coming. I think there's nearly 1,000 in town. And I'm really. It's great to be back. I was last here 10 years ago under Prime Minister Cameron as a minister for life science.
Life science, and you have some experience in that regard yourself.
Yes, I was 15 years in biotech. A bit of clean tech and agri tech venture capital before being elected 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. Seems like about an hour and a lifetime. But anyway. So I'm unusual in that way. I'm in the UK system, ministers often don't have a particular expertise in their field, and I've spent 13 years doing science and technology.
Well, right place, right time. George Freeman's our guest. So tell us about your role tomorrow. It sounds like it's quite extensive there at the Bio International Convention.
Yes, so it's a fantastic conference, great schedule, a lot of important talks about the sector. I'm there to set out our plan for the life sciences in the next few years in the UK. And we, you know, 10 years ago, we launched a big move. We set up the world's first genomic screening program, 100,000 NHS patients, full genome screened, connected to their hospital records. Hmm. I set up NHS Digital, which is our digital health system for the NHS. And we set up Biobank, which is the world's number one repository of tissues and clinical assets. And all of that, you know, in the pandemic was shown to be incredibly valuable. And, you know, we're very proud that at Oxford, the vaccine team there made the breakthrough by sequencing the virus. But now the whole world is chucking money at the life science sector. We have to up our game. Yeah. And so we've set out 10 days ago, and I'll be unpacking it tomorrow, a big, just short of £1 billion package. We're setting up seven disease missions focused on the big chronic diseases that are, well, causing so much pain and suffering, but also bankrupting our health systems. Mm. We're setting up a big play on clinical trials so we can get more people into trials in the NHS. We're investing in biomanufacturing. You know, in the old days, manufacturing the drug was just a powder or a tablet in a little popper. Now it's really sophisticated.
George,
genomics.
What are the diseases you're talking about?
So we've got seven big disease missions, one in cardiovascular, as you'd expect, one in dementia, we're doing a lot with the US there, one in mental health, one in addiction, one in cancer, one in vaccines, and one in, what have I missed, inflammation.
Mm. Good, good.
George, I'm curious as to your view of us. And I mean, I say us, I mean Boston, I mean Metro Boston, the state of Massachusetts, and all the progress that we've made in this particular area. How do you, in the UK, see what's going on here in Boston? And you know, I'm serious.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's partly why I'm here, is bio tomorrow. And then today I've been visiting MIT, and I've got about 15, 20 meetings across this ecosystem. And we recognize that this is one of the world's three key science and technology hubs, and I'm delighted the UK is one of the other three. But, you know, I was just at MIT just now, 70-odd Nobel Prize winners, of whom 26 were UK researchers working with MIT. So we have a really strong, long history together. And from the UK, I mean, the West Coast is amazing, but the East Coast, we have a stronger cultural bond. I think it feels more like home. It's easy. I mean, it's an easier, shorter flight. But, I mean, we see this cluster, the Boston cluster, as a huge powerhouse in medicine, life science, but also in the new technologies that are coming very quickly, quantum, engineering, biology, fusion. And we've set out a big program this 3 years, £52 billion in the UK. We're increasing our research budgets by 30%. And my job is to allocate that money and deepen our relationships with key R&D countries around the world. So I've signed deals with Japan, Israel, Switzerland, Norway. Yeah. But Boston is a whole nation really of its own in this field. And so we see it as one of the world's great clusters.
Well, this really gets me to what I think is one of my important questions. George Freeman with us, Minister of State for Science, Research and Innovation at the UK at the big Bio 2023. We have a business audience, as you know, and that's the reason you're here. I mean, what are you looking for besides poaching ideas and talent for your own country? What kinds of things would our audience be interested in hearing from you? I mean, what are the conversations you want to have and about what?
Yeah, thank you. Look, the first thing is we want to make very clear to people at Bio Tomorrow and folks listening the scale of our commitment and ambition. We've set out $9 billion investment in these 3 years, big move on clinical trials, these missions, and on regulation. The MHRA, our regulator, we're setting up a fast-track process, as the FDA have done, for both drugs, ILAP, and devices, IDAP. But the really big message, I think, is we see a global race in the life sciences, and nobody can rest on their laurels. The technology cycles are halving. What's really exciting is what happens when you start to put AI together with drug discovery, when you start to put advanced computing together with diagnostics.
What does happen when you do that, George, when you put AI in those positions?
Well, you dramatically accelerate drug discovery. So you cut out huge waste of time and money. I mean, the average drug traditionally takes 15 years, $2 billion, and has an 80% failure rate. That's why drugs are expensive, because we're paying for all the research that goes into the ones that actually eventually work. Well, with AI, you can dramatically find the patients who need, who suit a particular drug. You can much more quickly diagnose. You can drive through terabytes of genomic data, hospital record data, line, and find the patients who need the drug. And then you start to design the drug around a particular patient cohort. Instead of design a drug, the idea that it'll work for everybody, and after 13 years in trials, you narrow down the patients that you give it to. This is a revolution. You start with the patients, you start with tissues, you start with their disease histories and the genetics, and then you design the drug around the particular pathway.
George, are you here to talk to particular companies? I'm thinking, for instance, of Moderna. They're building a facility in Canada right now. Would you like a Moderna facility there in the UK? I mean, what's your short list of companies that you need to talk to this week?
Well, I'm delighted to say Moderna have just inked a massive investment in the UK BioNTech as well.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a sign of our deep science in cell and gene therapy. The really big message, I think, is clinical trials. We used to be a world leader in trials. The last two or three years, bizarrely, after the pandemic, where the NHS put together the world's biggest trial, bigger than the next 10 in the world put together and the quickest. We've actually dropped off a little in the last few years, clearing the backlog of the pandemic. So we've just made a major commitment on trials. We're going to get it down to 60-day recruitment, digitalize, universalize all the protocols. That's really important. I think, secondly, biomanufacturing. We're investing heavily in the cell and gene therapies, the advanced manufacturing of the drugs of tomorrow. These are going to be small batch, very personalized, smart medicines. It's not just powders tamped into a pill. This is really advanced, and we're investing heavily in that.
But when you say all this, do you want American companies to come set up shop in the UK?
Yeah. We're looking for both UK investors to come and invest in UK technologies, but we really want drug discovery, diagnostics, med tech companies to come and help us build the ecosystem of tomorrow in our healthcare system, and particularly in these key disease areas.
Our guest is George Freeman, the UK Minister of State for Science, Research and Innovation in Boston for the 2023 Boston Bio International Convention. You've touched upon it a little bit, but I'm curious as to what you're most proud of that you are doing, perhaps that we are not. What could we learn from you in what area?
Well, look, I think the great truth whenever the US and the UK get together in life sciences, all my American friends speak with misty-eyed enthusiasm about the NHS. Imagine having an integrated healthcare system. It treats 1.4 million patients every 24 hours. They're all in one system. It's all universal payment. I mean, imagine that as a research engine. And I think that is our great opportunity in the UK. Mm. We can find patients very quickly. We can find 500,000 dementia patients, 200,000 rare disease patients. The challenge for us is how to combine that with the very best of American tertiary research medicine. And some of your research hospitals are just, world-beating, as are some of ours. And I think the challenge is for a modern healthcare system, how can we use the NHS as a research engine to find the right patients, accelerate the process of getting new drugs, getting data approval, so that if you develop a new drug in the US, you come to the UK because it's a quick place to find patients, get the data, prove who it works in, get the stamp of approval. This drug is 90% successful in this cohort, and then you can go around the world with that data in your pocket. Then that's the real value, I think, of the NHS.
The real power. George Freeman with us, going to this Bio 2023. Now, you've talked about the money you can spend. You have quite a package. You're also, as I understand it, aiming to recruit up to 5 million people to develop ways to prevent, detect, and treat diseases. It brings to mind a question we often ask on this program, and that is, in biotech and other sectors, it's very difficult these days to find people. Are you finding the same?
Yeah. So this is a really good question. The real holy grail in this new life science ecosystem is patients. And we've rather taken them for granted, I think, for decades.
The patients, okay.
Yeah.
The covered lives, as it were.
Yeah, the patients wait at the end, rather patiently, for the drugs. And in the new ecosystem, it starts with the patients. It starts with patients enrolling in trials, patients giving consent. We're driving digitalization here so that patients can, if you get a diabetes diagnosis, I'm probably not far away from one. We want to get to a system where you can slide, you know, you have a password, you join the NHS diabetes portal, you slide the consent bar, give me access to trials, you slide the consent bar, share my medical records with charities, researchers, and then we can start to make it much quicker to get people into research medicine. And then we have an offer for industry, which is, are you looking for, you know, 200,000 rare disease patients? Come to the UK. We can find them for you. They're enrolled in trials programs. They're keen to do research medicine. And, you know, we spend $1.4 billion a year on the National Institute of Health Research embedded in the NHS.
Mm.
That is very powerful because you're right. In the end, people, finding people into trial medicine is that's the key, really.
Okay.
Anything you want to do while you're here in Boston besides this?
Well, I'd love to go and see a Red Sox game.
Mm. You would, huh? They're playing right now. Kim, what's the score there?
Still 0-0.
Still 0-0.
They're not doing very well.
Not doing very well.
Or maybe the New England Revolution.
Oh, that's true, too.
Are we in soccer season here?
Yeah.
I think they're playing down there.
We think so.
Yeah.
we're not the same size.
Have you been to Fenway?
No.
You've never been to Fenway?
No, but you should see my schedule. I mean, I'm here for 3 days. It's about 28 meetings.
Well, your people are all here. They can figure something out.
They can figure something out. I'm not coming all this way.
I mean, if you left now, you could probably make the fifth inning at Fenway Park.
Is it the seventh inning stretch? Is that what you call it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Associated Industries of Massachusetts. It's an organization that represents some 3,500 employers statewide. And every month they come out what is known as the Business Confidence Index. And May's number is out. And, well, it's not great news. Let's bring in John Regan. He is the president and CEO of AIM and a frequent visitor to the program. We welcome him back. John, welcome. Tell us about the May number, the Business Confidence Index, how it works and what it means.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it. So, as you said, we've been doing this monthly since the early 1990s. We get around 140, 150 companies to participate. And it's a system that we've developed to sort of gauge employers' mood about the economy. And so for the first time since December of 2020, the mood turned slightly negative. Just remind your listeners, anything below 50 is considered negative. And for the month of May, we were at 49.6. So barely negative, but negative nonetheless. And I think the more important thing to look at with the Business Confidence Index is this a one-time blip, or does this represent sort of a more permanent change in attitude? And we'll have to wait until next month and perhaps the month after before we see if the trend is taking hold in a big way.
So, John, this also, and you point this out in your presentation on all this, these numbers were calculated before McCarthy and Biden wrapped up a debt ceiling agreement. And how much of a factor might that have been?
I think it was a factor. I think the fact that the debate around that issue seemed to be not being resolved, at least not in any serious way until the very end. I think people look at that and wonder, what other negative effects would that have caused had the resolution not been achieved? And then when you add back in concerns about inflation, which continues to be high, and the high cost of capital. It's interesting. I talked to several business leaders and others in the finance industry, and we haven't seen a rate climate like this in business lending for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so for folks who haven't experienced higher interest rates, it adds to cost, it adds to complexity, it adds to risk, and that might make people, sit back and wait until those rates come back down again.
Talking to John Regan, President and CEO of AIM, the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, talking about the Business Confidence Index, which moved into pessimistic territory just below 50 for the month of May. John, what could they do there on Beacon Hill to turn this around, to get us back on the other side of 50? I know we are waiting for various tax packages. The Senate may be out with something soon. House has already showed its hand. The governor as well. What do you want to see from Beacon Hill?
So I have to start with this. I'm very heartened by the language that the governor and the House and Senate leadership have been using around worrying about the economy. We're worried about affordability for residents, and we're worried about competitiveness for the business climate. So the fact that that's what everyone's talking about is a very positive thing, in my opinion. And certainly a tax package which tries to address both of those concerns would be very welcome. And I think the sooner that gets done, the better, because it starts to signal that state government is you know, back in the game, or in the quest for competitiveness on behalf of Massachusetts employers.
Yeah, and John, how much of that filters into all this, into the way that you, the people you talk to, the way they think about the here and now and the future?
Yes, if you look at the component figures that make up the index, companies feel positive about their own control over their own destiny. But then when you ask them about Massachusetts and even the U.S., U.S. is among the most negative readings in this month's index, and Massachusetts is just slightly below 50. So, you know, it's the type of thing where I think some positive movement on public policy, things that matter to employers, would brighten the mood considerably in my opinion.
Wait a second, we have breaking news.
We are number one.
We're number one. We're number one.
The big dog. Ruff, ruff.
Big dog. Ruff, ruff.
I'm Joey Tribbiani, and here are today's top stories.
All right, here it is, the number one story. And Kim has been talking about this, by the way. Apple debuts $3,499 Vision Pro headset in test of marketing. Now, what is this? It's a they're calling it a mixed reality headset. Virtual reality, augmented reality. Apple thinks it's the future of computing. That's how sure they are. But experts, including our own Mark Gurman, say it could be one of the riskiest launches in the company's history. This is the first new category for Apple since the smartwatch in 2015. We're going to have more on this tomorrow, on the details and exactly what this device does. I'm looking at a picture now, Apple Vision Pro. It's space age, baby. That's the number one story on the Bloomberg Terminal. Joe?
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Maroney. Sir, okay. You know, today kicked off the Bio International Conference for biotech and pharma executives, taking place at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. Our own Ann Mostu moderated one of the panels today between, I think, 2 and 3 o'clock, and Ann joins us now live. Ann, do tell.
Yes, Joe, Tom, and Kim, it was a really interesting day here at Bio. This is an enormous conference, at least 25,000 people. And essentially, the panel today that I did was great. It's a topic top of mind for most people in the industry, raising capital in tough markets. So it's a panel of CFOs and CEOs. This was an off-the-record conversation, but these were public companies, Insmed, Apellis, Resolute Bio, and Deciphera Pharma. And they talked very openly about how they've faced data that were disappointing in the last couple of years, disappointing to both scientists and investors, and a cash crunch, and the mechanics involved in pursuing and securing secondary offerings and future financing. And they just talked about strategy and also investor relations. So it was a very, very well-received panel. A lot of folks in the audience were CFOs interested to hear how people are staying afloat. And then earlier this week, I caught up with really the heads of it all, Kendall Berlin O'Connell, CEO of MassBio, and Rachel King, CEO of Bio International, the conference organizer. And I started by asking King to give a sense of how the Bio conference is significant.
Bio is the world's largest international biotechnology conference, and we're thrilled to be back in Boston this year. It's the founding city of many really important biotechnology companies. And so it's a great opportunity for us to gather the community, the international community in Boston.
For us here in Massachusetts, it's our opportunity to welcome the world to the number one life science ecosystem anywhere. We really get to showcase all the amazing innovation that's happening right here in Massachusetts. And last time the conference was here, it was in 2018, and I believe we had 22,000 attendees.
Yeah, we do think the conference this year is going to be one of the biggest ever. So we're expecting a lot of people there. And as we said, from all around the world, not only meeting and networking, but attending sessions. And we also do a big partnering effort at the conference. And we expect there are going to be over 45,000 individual partnering meetings that are set up through the conference. So there will be a lot of opportunities for people to gather and to network, to share ideas, and to look to the future together.
Now, biotech went through its IPO boom. Now the shakeout is sort of underway. Industry stocks falling for the past 2 years, public debuts cooling. What do you think is ahead?
Well, I would say, you know, biotech has been through many cycles over many years. There are ebbs and flows in biotechnology, as there are in many industries. At the same time, I think that we're continuing to deliver really important treatments and in some cases cures to patients. And so the industry, I think, is going to continue to thrive even as we come out of this this particular mini, let's call it a downturn that that has happened. But, you know, the scientific innovations continue to be very important and exciting, and these are going to continue to drive new treatments. So I think biotechnology's industry is going to continue to thrive.
Yeah, and here in Massachusetts, we've weathered this storm many times. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the number one life science ecosystem in the world. We have over 1,000 biotech companies right here in Massachusetts. And, you know, we are continuing to see strong company creation. We've seen over $3 billion of VC investment come to Massachusetts headquarter companies so far this year. So yes, the landscape looks a little different than it did in 2020, 2021, but we are continuing to see, importantly, innovation continue to be funded and happening here in Massachusetts. So I do think the second half of the year, we'll see a little bit of loosening.
Now, there has been the good news of movement of manufacturing here in the U.S., and in particularly here in Massachusetts. I've done a few stories on Central Mass, new facilities opening up to manufacture drugs. What do you see in terms of that ahead?
So I really think that manufacturing, particularly biomanufacturing, is the next chapter for life sciences here in Massachusetts. We are the perfect location to host your biomanufacturing, right? Companies who have their R&D located, whether it's in Cambridge, Boston, or anywhere. We have geography on our side. So to be able to do your biomanufacturing in close proximity is really, really important. So when you think of the future of this industry here in Massachusetts, that's where we really need to continue to invest. Make sure Massachusetts is a destination for manufacturing.
And this is an area, too, where the federal government plays an important role. And biomanufacturing actually is a priority for the current administration. So there are good things that do sometimes come out of the public policy world. We're also facing some challenges at the same time with some recent legislation, in particular, the drug pricing negotiations out of the Inflation Reduction Act. But I think with respect to biomanufacturing, we do certainly appreciate the administration's support. And it's great to see places like Massachusetts that have such a strong presence where I'm sure we can continue to build.
And then one more question. There are obviously going to be very large companies and smaller private companies at Bio. What do you think they're hoping to get out of the conference?
Well, this is where the partnering really is so important. As I said a moment ago, we're going to expect to have over 45,000 individual meetings scheduled. So the way the partnering works at the Bio Convention is that small companies and large companies and academic institutions, for that matter, can all participate and use the system to match interested parties. So it's actually really exciting to watch. If you're on the floor there, you see people going in and out of these meeting rooms. You hear the bells when the meetings change. And it's really a wonderful opportunity. We also have what we call stand-up stadium, where we have companies that are presenting. So these are opportunities for companies to basically tell their story to potential investors. So there are a lot of things that we're doing to really showcase companies at all different stages of development and to facilitate their getting together with potential partners.
Yeah, the exciting thing about the Bio Convention being here in Massachusetts is we get to convene, connect, and catalyze our entire ecosystem under this conference, right? So many emerging biotechs. This is their chance to get in front of potential partners, potential investors, potential collaborators in just a few days. It's really, really exciting.
And one of the other things that's exciting about being in Massachusetts is that not only, as Kendall just said, not only do we have a lot of emerging companies in Massachusetts, but Massachusetts also has some wonderful examples of companies that were emerging at one point and have successfully actually gone through the very long process of raising money, developing drugs, and actually getting them on the market and delivering them to patients. So it's not only a place where there's a lot starting, but a place where a lot has already been accomplished. So it's really an inspiration, I think, to a lot of the smaller, newer companies to be having this convention here in Boston.
Yeah, there has been a lot of support in the form of grants and things like that lately from obviously federal, state, and local governments.
Absolutely. You know, their sentiment time and time again is, They don't want us to just maintain our leadership position in the life sciences, but they really want to help us extend our lead. I might just say, and you know, we're really, really excited to have the incredible support from the Healy administration for this event, as well as Mayor Wu and so many other leaders around the Commonwealth. But this, again, is our opportunity to showcase the strength of the Massachusetts life science ecosystem. So to have our partners in government showing up in full force is just truly incredible.
I would add that we've got some really exciting keynote speakers, and there were two that I would highlight. Katie Couric is going to be coming, and her presence at the convention is really important because of all the work that she's done as a patient advocate. I think it's important for all of us. I know many people in their individual work really keep the patients front of mind, and so having her speak about the journey as a caregiver and as a patient herself is going to be really important and I think impactful to people who are listening. The other keynote that I would highlight is with Dr. Califf, the commissioner of the FDA. And one of the things that we are really fortunate to have in the United States is a regulatory agency that really is the gold standard for the world. And to have him join us in Boston and to share some of his views about the importance of standing up for science, which is our theme for the convention, I think is also going to be very meaningful to attendees today.
Again, that's Rachel King, CEO of Bio International, which is putting on this conference, about 20 to 25,000 people, and Kendall Berlin O'Connell, CEO of MassBio. And those keynote speeches are tomorrow and Wednesday. Katie Couric tomorrow, Dr. Califf Wednesday. Also, appearances from Governor Healy, the American Diabetes Association, Sanofi, and Biogen are making big presentations tomorrow. So it's all taken over the city, really, until Thursday.
Yeah, it does run through Thursday the 8th. And so tell us about what you'll be up to tomorrow.
Well, I'm hoping to bounce around to a few different presentations. And it's an interesting mix of people presenting data and then executive conversations, like scientists becoming CEOs and leadership skills, a lot on intellectual property and artificial intelligence. So I'm really interested to hear some of the more newsworthy topics and see what people will say in the hallway to me and then see what people will let me record in the sessions.
Very good, Ian. It sounds like you're running things over there, so keep up the good work.
All right.
You got it.
Yeah, she's Ann Mostow. We'll hear a lot more from her tomorrow as the Bio International Convention continues here in Boston right through Thursday.
There you go. The governor, huh?
Yeah.
All right, Joe, let's talk about tomorrow. It's Tuesday, as we know. Now, you may remember recently we did had a conversation with a gentleman who was auctioning off the Cheers bar, the real deal that was in the TV show. They've done so.
Yeah.
He's coming back for a return appearance tomorrow to tell us how much he fetched on that particular property. He's also got all kinds of other Hollywoodania. Is that a word?
I don't think so.
No, I just
not recently.
Anyway. Hollywoodania. You know, it's like
paraphernalia.
You know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
Jen will have part two of her Boston Harbor cruises, and we'll have lots more. It's Bloomberg Bay State Business, but Bloomberg Daybreak Asia that starts right now.